All right, so let's go ahead and get started. Again, this is Ben Johnson with the American Immigration Council, and maybe I can give folks a little bit more time by just doing a quick introduction and then getting out of the way and letting the folks that have been doing this work, doing incredible work, you know, both here in Washington, but most significantly on the ground in Dilley, Texas, to talk to you a little bit about what's been happening. So I just want to say that I think, you know, this, what's been happening in family detention for those of us who have been around immigration issues for a long, long time and have seen many ups and downs in the immigration debate and weathered those storms, you know, hopefully fairly well and always been persistent about, you know, keeping our eyes on the values that we all hope would drive the immigration debate, but, you know, sometimes doesn't. Even for the most seasoned veterans, this watching what's unfold in the family detention context has been really, really difficult. It has been, I've described it most often, as just a gut punch, right? The idea that we have gotten to the point where we literally would sacrifice women and children fleeing undeniable violence from the Northern Triangle of Central America for, you know, on the altar of political expediency or with some goal of sending home a message to those suffering at home to not come to the United States, that we would so quickly abandon, you know, basic principles of fairness and due process and our commitment to refugees and asylees has really been very difficult. And I think the way that we have responded as a community, and certainly the way we've responded in the CARA project, is to channel that frustration and anger towards helping these people in any and every way that we possibly can. And I think as much as a lot of what you're going to hear is going to be a continuation of this very sad tale in the history of U.S. immigration policy. The truth is there has been lots of little victories along the way, litigation that forced the agency to stop its policies of using a broad deterrence strategy on individual parole or bond determinations, the attention that was brought to poisoning children with the over-vaccination and the agency's effort to respond to that, some of the decision that we've seen in the Flores, all of those have been important victories that continue to shine a light on the fact that this is an unsustainable strategy. It's not only morally reprehensible, but it is an unsustainable strategy, both as a matter of law and as a matter of common sense application of resources. And the only way that we've been able to get those victories is because of the dedication of the folks you're going to hear from, you know, Ian and Isabel and Lindsay and Brian and Michelle and other folks that have been on the ground through sweat and tears and just an endless willingness to work through and help these people is how we've gotten to where we are. And I'm just going to lead this call by saying, you know, we can't abandon them any more than we can abandon the women and children that they are trying to help. We need more resources and we need more attention on the ground at Dilley. And I know from looking at the list of folks that are on this call that a lot of you are in this fight, and maybe, you know, asking you for a donation is not going to be the smartest thing I can do, but we need resources. So we're going to be asking for your help, your financial help. And if you can't give financial help, then we need your voice, and we need your effort, and we need your engagement on this issue, because it's clear that the government is not going to stop doing this unless we make them stop. And that's not going to happen with three people on the ground alone. We have to support them with resources, to get more people and more resources on the ground for the reasons that you'll understand soon, because this problem is not going away, and in many areas it's getting worse. And if you can't help them with resources, then I need you to help them with your voice and with your involvement and your engagement in any and every way that you can. So I will talk more about that, but for me, the underlying messages here, the stories you're going to hear from these incredibly hardworking people, are stories that we have to support And they are people that we have to support, not only those that we're helping, but those that are doing the helping. So with that, I will stop for now. But I want to say that you're going to hear more about this fundraising efforts. I'm just going to say it right out here up front. You can text Dilley, and that's D-I-L-L-E-Y. Text Dilley to 41444, and you could donate right now. Our effort is going to be to raise $25,000 by the end of the month to get more resources, more people on the ground to do the work that you're going to hear absolutely needs to be done. So there will be more follow-up emails, and I will repeat that again. You can text Dilley, D-I-L-L-E-Y, to 41444 to donate now. And if you can't donate now, then please reach out to us and let us know how you can help in other ways. Lindsay, I'll stop there and turn it over to you and talk a little bit about what's going on and to introduce Ian and Isabel.
Sure. Thank you, Ben. So I'm Lindsay Harris. I'm a legal fellow with the American Immigration Council focused on efforts to end family detention to shut this thing down. So thank you for all being with us on a Friday afternoon to try and give you an update. And for many of you on the call, you know what's going on because you've been there on the ground, and we so appreciate that. But because we have a whole bunch of people on the call, before I introduce our project coordinator and one of our staff attorneys on the ground with the CARA project, I would just like to share a couple of key updates. So as Ben said, unfortunately, family detention is not over, nowhere near over. Even after the court's decision in Flores in August, which said the government shouldn't, as a general matter, detain children in these unlicensed secure facilities and should release them promptly to a parent, including the parent with whom they were apprehended. So the mom should also be released in general. We've seen, in response to that, the government has absolutely ramped up the number of children and mothers that are detained at the facility in Dilley, in Carnes City, and in Berks County, Pennsylvania. At Dilley, where the council is most involved, we've seen the population double between mid-August, when we were down to close to 1,000 people detained at Dilley, and the beginning of September, when we got close to 2,000, and we're hovering around there now. So around 2,000 children and their moms are being held for varying lengths of time, and unfortunately, as of this week, younger and younger kids are being brought in, so we're starting to see again those nursing, breastfeeding infants, 18 months to 2 years old, at the facility. So we anticipate that the government is going to continue to use Dilley and Carnes as so-called short-term processing facilities. The government believes that the detention of children and their mothers for an average of 20 days is permissible post-Flores. That's not our reading of Flores, but they have until October 23rd to comply, and I can confirm from the highest levels of ICE and DHS that they read compliance with Flores as holding these women and children in these detention facilities in the conditions that we'll discuss for 3 weeks, and that's permissible. Whether or not that's actually true, they don't actually seem able to meet that deadline. So we had a couple of questions that were sent in prior to the call beginning. We'll try to address those. But I can say that for most of August, for CARA project clients, and keep in mind, there are some people at the facility at Dilley who are falling through the cracks. We saw an average of 42 days in terms of the length of detention. So this is basic background, but what have we been doing to try and help these families detained by our government who are, after all, fleeing persecution in Central America? So you probably all know that the CARA Pro Bono Family Detention Project was launched this year by four organizations. So that's Clinic, the American Immigration Council, Raíces, and AILA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And Raíces really focuses their efforts and attention at Carnes, and the council, AILA, and clinics focus on providing pro bono representation on the ground to the moms and kids detained at the largest facility, capacity 2,400, which is officially known as the South Texas Family Residential Center. We do this with a skeletal staff on the ground, and I'll introduce two of our three staff members shortly. We're able to do that through incredible volunteer support. Many of you have flown down to, through AILA or otherwise to San Antonio. You've rented cars, stayed in hotels, all on your own dime, and attended orientation on Sunday, and you're in the facility every day, Monday to Friday, and now more and more often Saturdays too, And this has been going on since March. So I think 330 volunteers have spent a week on the ground, sometimes more than a week. And in response to one question I received, these teams are between 7 and actually 27 people we have on the ground this week. We have a team of law students from Columbia, but usually around 15. So the volunteers are absolutely instrumental in preparing the mothers detained at Dilley for what are known as credible or reasonable fear interviews. So almost all of these families are fleeing violence in the Northern Triangle countries and have expressed a fear of returning home. They have an interview with an asylum officer lasting an hour to maybe 2 hours, usually less, where the officer explores their claim and figures out whether there is a significant possibility that they could be successful in claiming protection in the U.S. So U.S. immigration law, as many of us know regarding asylum and protection, is exceedingly complex. So the women greatly benefit from the legal advice and sometimes representation at these interviews, although, as Ian and Isabel will discuss, that's becoming increasingly difficult given the volume of clients we're seeing every day for us to actually represent and accompany these women to the interviews. One question I received was, what is this EFI-RFI grant rate? We know from USCIS in the last week, they say it's between 90 to 95%, and the statistics have remained close to 90% throughout our time at Dilley. So to get a sense of what's going on right now on the ground at Dilley, I would like to introduce Ian Philibon, who is our Intrepid Project Coordinator on the ground. Ian, if you can speak to your role on the ground and what a typical day is looking like right now for staff and volunteers at Dilley, that would be great.
Yeah, thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you all for being on the call today. So the typical day that we have here in my role, it centers around the coordination of the legal services that we're providing to all the women that are detained here within the facility, all the volunteer staff that come to provide these services on any given week, and then all of our interactions and coordination that we actually do with CCA staff, the staff of ICE present here on the ground, and then, of course, USCIS and the asylum office. So the days begin at 7 a.m. when we arrive here at the facility, and we generally see women until about 7 p.m., sometimes as late as 8 p.m. when the visitation center where we provide all these services closes to legal services, in which time we will see anywhere between 100 to 175 women with, as Lindsay stated, between 7 and 27 volunteers plus the 3 permanent staff members we have on the ground. Now, with these meetings, we see clients based on the various stages of the legal process that we find them in. It could be their very first meeting with us where we have to go over who we are, what our services that we provide are, and what our engagement could potentially look like, to preparing them for their credible fear interviews or the reasonable fear interviews, and then ultimately when they are preparing to go before an immigration judge about what their bond hearing would look like, or perhaps if they are going to have a review of a negative decision concerning their credible or reasonable fear interview. So these days are quite long, and there's a very, very high pace in terms of the number of people that we're actually about that we see on any given day, and we definitely make our volunteers work very hard. And then once we finish seeing women and children as they're coming into the facility, we have a post-workday meeting, which we call the big table meeting, which we do off-site, where all the volunteer staff and the permanent staff here on the ground kind of review and discuss observations, new developments that we've seen with the cases that we're dealing with, and strategies that we're going to employ moving forward. This serves two purposes, both functional purposes to improve what we're doing on the ground on a given day so we can better the services that we provide the next day, and then also to report back to all the different pieces that are involved with the care organization off the ground to make sure that we have them fully employed with the information and the realities that we're looking like on any given day. And this is a model that works on a weekly basis because, as Lindsay stated, we have volunteers coming in basically from Sunday until Saturday. There's an orientation that we do by phone every Wednesday with our off-the-ground staff, And then they come in on Sunday evening, and we do a 3 to 3.5 hour volunteer orientation on the ground at the ranch where we live, so that they can be best prepared to come into the facility at 7 a.m. on Monday morning and immediately begin seeing these clients. So not only is the daily pace very rapid and strenuous, so is the weekly pace, because we have to repeat it over and over again and make sure that we are preparing these volunteers to come in and operate at the highest capacity and provide the best possible quality services to these women while they're in this facility.
And this is Lindsay. You guys do an incredible job with that, but it's a lot to ask. So I'd like to introduce Isabel Saavedra, who is a staff attorney on the ground contracted through our partner organization clinic, who can speak to the role of the attorney volunteers, the legal volunteers, in actually preparing mothers for credible and reasonable fair interviews. And Isabel, if you could just let us know what you guys are able to do right now in terms of preparing these women and how you're doing it, that would be fantastic.
Thank you, Lindsay. And hello, everyone. I want to thank you for taking the time to be in this call today. And so as Lindsay and Ian mentioned, post Flores decision, the population, unfortunately, is not going down like we thought it was going to happen. And for the last 2 weeks, we have seen the credible fear interviews and the reasonable fear interviews go up. The asylum office actually are bringing more officers to conduct more interviews, and they are doing approximately 61 interviews a day, including Saturday, and they're considering to going into Sunday. And so, you know, when there's 9 volunteers in the ground and we have 61 credible fear interviews to prepare women, it is very, very difficult. But we are trying our best, and we usually try to come up with solutions to this and at least make sure that no one falls through the cracks. And what we've been doing when we have low volunteers for a week, we conduct what we call a credible fear interview charlas. And charlas are it's like talks, or where we bring women and we try to bring women in a group of about 8 to 10 women, and we give them an introduction. We empower them to say that no one knows your story as better as you do, and that we're here to support you and give you the right tools to make sure you go there and you come with a positive decision. Right now, we are conducting about 3 to 4 charlas a day, depending on the amount of people that we have. And we also, if we have a lot of volunteers that week after the charla, we let them have a one-to-one with an attorney to prepare them better, to try to help them strategize on how to tell their story, how they can be more efficient, and make sure that they do get the positive that we want them to get. So, but this is definitely very difficult, because sometimes, we are seeing a lot of medical issues on the ground. There's definitely not enough people to help the women with the conditions that they're coming after spending several days at the icebox. So children are sick, mothers are sick, so when we have to prepare the children don't want to leave their mother's side for 10 seconds. So when we have to prepare the women for the credible fear interviews with a crying baby on their hands, it's very, very difficult. But, you know, we try to have coloring books, crayons, a little bit of chocolate to try to make this process as easier as we can, and hope that, you know, that we can make this happen. So,
wow, thank you, Isabel. And everybody should also remember, of course, that these women, the stories that they're telling are absolutely stories of trauma, of rape, of abuse, sometimes lifetimes of abuse that they're escaping. So that's a great deal of secondary trauma, vicarious trauma for our volunteers and staff to take on. In addition to all of this preparation for the actual legal proceeding that the women and their kids are undergoing at Dili, we're also trying to track advocacy efforts on the ground. So, Ian, I'm hoping you can speak to your role in the advocacy efforts. Specifically, what are the major issues that we're still seeing? You know, we've heard problems about the medical care. Ben mentioned the over-vaccination of 252 children earlier in the summer, but we've also documented other medical problems. If you could speak to that and other key advocacy issues that we're trying to track and document to hold the government accountable, that would be wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah, as Ben mentioned, obviously the vaccination issue that occurred several months ago kind of speaks on a larger and slightly more obvious level of the lack of capacity and the lack of institutionalized best practices that are involved in the provision of a lot of services that occur within this facility, even though there seems to be a claim at every opportunity that they are only providing the best conditions and situations to all these women and children. So these advocacy efforts that we're doing are both to document those moments where we find those claims to be erroneous, and then also look at some really basic human rights violations, including other medical issues and some access to counsel issues. So some of the major problems that we see along the medical vein are very, very simple in terms of just basic access to medical services. We are being told that on average when women are seeking care, especially during the daytime, within the medical clinic, that they're waiting on average between 3 to 5 hours. And 3 to 5 hours in a facility where we see 100% of the children being sick. A lot of this has to do with the time that they spent at the border in the ice box when they were detained by CBP and Border Patrol. They arrive here and the illness, as it started up, kind of perpetuates itself. And then within the facility, the environment in which they are living with these other people that have also faced similar conditions really turn into a more egregious problem. And while these medical services they claim to be providing are so great, we're documenting very thoroughly and across the board with everyone that we're seeing here that it's exactly the opposite of what they're claiming. And this also comes into play with the resources that they have within the medical services facility to provide to these women. So many women come in and tell us that not only are they not given any medication, they don't think they have anything. The only thing that we hear about these women being given when they have children with the flu or with a fever or with infections is Tylenol or honey or the most common prescription, which is drink more water. So we're documenting all of these egregious abuses, and unfortunately sometimes we have to do such things as call 911 because the child needs such urgent medical care and they're not receiving it from the facility. Other problems that we're seeing here that we document in our advocacy efforts are with access to counsel. We are providing these legal services here within the visitation center, which is not a formal office setting, and we do not have formal infrastructure as one would think of in a professional office. So there is a barrier to entrance here, which is CCA staff who are trained to make sure that they are filtering everybody that comes through and documenting which women see which volunteers for legal services. And there is a limit to the amount of people that are allowed to be in this facility, which is limited in its capacity in its own right at any given time. Then we have the interactions that they have with the ICE officers are often based on erroneous or misleading information. And the clients come in and tell us of these instances that they have with their ICE officers and their deportation officers. And we have been collecting this information and have a good list of affidavits taken on various topics. One of the most egregious cases is the manipulation of these women's understanding of what their release can look like. And there are basically two ways that women are being released into the United States from this facility. One is with a bond that they receive from an immigration judge. And this is very legal light here, but just so you can have some baseline information. One, so we have a bond that they can be issued in some of the cases from an immigration judge, or we have ICE can issue conditions of release for these women, which they refer to as an alternative to detention, or ATD. Now, currently, this means leaving with an ankle monitor, or as we like to call it, an ankle shackle. And as soon as women are receiving their positive credible fear interview decisions, which means that they are able to receive release conditions, ICE is calling their family members, telling them to buy tickets, and then telling the women that they're able to leave without paying any money on their word, or ATD, which ATD, of course, means nothing to them, as many of these processes do. And we have them signing a piece of paper unknowingly that it means that they will be leaving with this shackle with GPS capabilities around their ankle, and that will be their livelihood for the next undisclosed period of months in the United States while they are supposed to be starting their asylum proceedings. So this has been a very uncomfortable conversation that we've had to have with both the women and their various levels of understanding of what that means, and, of course, with the ICE officials to try to get them to understand why we feel this is such an egregious manipulation of their understanding of their legal process and their rights and what that looks like in terms of a just livelihood outside of the confines of this detention center, and how this alternative to detention is actually just another form of detention just outside of these walls. And the last issue that we've really been trying to capture on a large level is problems we've been having with indigenous language speakers. The services provided within this facility obviously lack the ability to provide all of the necessary social services and legal services to the hundreds and hundreds of women and children that are from the Western Highlands of Guatemala who speak between 7 and 9 different indigenous languages that we see on any given week. So this lack of access to information and services in their own language starts at the border, and the manipulation of these women and the misunderstandings that they encounter as they're going through their own legal proceedings starts days before they even get here, and we try to offer them up some good legal counsel and services. And so we've been documenting what those look like, how that challenges their ability to use their own agency within their legal proceedings, and our ability to advocate for them because of the lack of resources to serve that population. So those are some really key items that we've been focusing on with these advocacy issues.
Thank you, Ian. I mean, all of those are critically important issues, right? Access to counsel, ICE has specifically not allowed our attorneys and volunteers into meetings with ICE, even when we have a G28, which is a representation form, on file with them. They're denying us access to these meetings where they're discussing these alternatives to detention. And the medical problems, I mean, everybody on the call is outraged by the conditions that you describe, and then the issues for indigenous language speakers. So it's really important that we document and push and advocate and potentially litigate on all of these issues. Back to you, Isabel. How can we effectively handle all of these efforts in light of the volume of moms that we're seeing coming in every day in the visitation trailer? I think between 100 and 140 mothers, you said. So how can we, or how are we doing that?
Okay, so, I mean, I think that since, for now, the Flores decision hasn't been what we thought it was going to be, or it didn't bring the results that we wanted to bring, in order to effectively be able to shut this place down, we need to really focus on advocacy efforts and try to document this all the egregious things that are happening down here. So it's very, very hard to do this with the amount of women that we have to see, but we do the best that we can, and inevitably we have to focus on the underlying legal case so we make sure that these women get out of here as soon as possible, even if that means we have to miss some issues and not be able to document them. ICE is moving people in and out of the facility faster every day. And in order to be able to shut this place down, we need to prove that they're not able to meet their date of 20 days. So we need to make sure we document this and we make their lives harder. But obviously we don't want to sacrifice the women to do that. So we really, what we try is to inform the women and make them make and help them make an educated decision as to whether they're going to leave on the ankle monitors. But, you know, right now, since there's so many women here, we only get to see them twice if we're lucky. So sometimes, you know, we might not see them again after they get a positive reasonable fear interview or credible fear interview.
Right. Thank you, Ian and Isabel. And I'm imagining there isn't much capacity on the ground to go ahead and track down those women after they've been released, which is a whole other piece of what needs to be done. So how would having another person, more people on the ground, and, you know, granted you get amazing, experienced, awesome volunteers coming in every week, but how would having other people, another person there more permanently help you to better serve these families and to advocate for the end of family detention?
Okay, so for the past 4 weeks, we've been having biweekly liaison meetings with ICE and ERL. So having a third person here could free us up into making sure that, you know, we are able to attend these liaison meetings. And it would also give us a little bit more free time for us to sleep and be better rested, because sometimes, unfortunately, we are so drained and so tired that, you know, coming here after not being able to sleep for many hours, it's hard to be energized and give everything we got. And I can speak for Ian, Brian, and I. We are very passionate about this project. I think that this project has been the best thing I've done professionally. And after seeing what the government is doing with these women and children, being part of the CARA project makes me a proud citizen of this nation. So seeing how everyone came together to help these women, you know, will give us more passion to come and give all we got. And I'll let also Ian talk more about this.
Yeah, and to speak on that point as well, while we're considering all of the allegations that we're bringing against the lack of capacity and lack of best practices here on the ground to actually provide these services to the women on the part of ICE and CCA, if we fall into the same category of driving ourselves into the ground and we're not 100% every time that we are trying to serve these women, then there comes a certain point when we have to challenge ourselves to improve our own systems so that we are only providing the highest quality services, both in terms of our direct work with these women and also the quality of our advocacy work in the long term. And so bringing in more fresh and energized faces to work directly with these people, to focus and really drive home these projects 100%, documenting every single egregious medical case, documenting every egregious denial of access to counsel, documenting every manipulation of these women from ICE officers while they are being detained here and cut off from the outside world and their very basic human and legal rights, needs to be a priority that we continue to focus on as we improve our system. And I think another thing that we need to keep in mind when we're focusing on these ideas is we need to be institutionalizing the way that we focus on our end game, which is the end of family detention, and not the best practices for how we come here and serve these women on a daily basis. And in order to do so, we really need to be focused, and we need to be acting fast rather than making this a very functional work environment. It needs to be one that is 100% directed at ending this practice entirely.
And I also want to add that, you know, when women are here detained, they have no right. They're being denied their right to access to legal counsel. So, you know, I think that by having another person on the ground, would give us, would allow us to start accompanying, you know, these some of the most vulnerable women to their credible and reasonable fear interviews and provide representation. For the past, I want to say, month or so, we haven't been able to go with them, and we shouldn't just be empowering them. You know, we need to make sure that we make the government's job harder and make their lives harder. So, you know, if the CARA Project has the capacity to go to every single credible fear interview and make sure that the women are getting the interviews that they deserve and, you know, 2 hours, because I guarantee you that with 60 interviews a day, those interviews cannot be the best interviews that these women deserve. So if we make sure we're there being, you know, a police and making their life harder, that's another strategy to close this place down.
And I'd like to add one final point very briefly. Isabel stated earlier that we are seeing sometimes only 2 interactions with each woman. And we really have to be conscious of the fact that upon release from this facility, they are going off into the United States where they will be responsible to proceed and comply with their entire asylum proceedings, which is a very difficult thing to do, especially when you are not equipped with the information and resources necessary to do so. And I think that would be another very important goal of this project that we lack the capacity to adequately do currently, would be to employ them with all those resources in the most organized way.
Thank you so much, Ian and Isabel. There's a tremendous amount that you are all doing on the ground already with legal representation and preparation for these interviews with the asylum office, court representation. There are still bond hearings going on. We're also asking you to do a lot in terms of advocacy and documenting the conditions at the facility and the access to counsel issues. Another thing that we're trying to launch, and we're in negotiations with ICE on this, hopefully in the next week, is pre-release orientations for women to try and, as Ian says, equip with their rights and responsibilities. So this is yet another ask we're going to be making of our staff and our volunteers. We should have permission to conduct those 3 times a week to groups of women to basically let them know how you change your venue in your case, how you find an attorney, what you have to do to report to a check-in, how to file your application within 1 year of arrival, how to get a work permit after 6 months, etc. So thank you so much for outlining what's going on and what you need to continue this work and to really effectively work to end family detention. We have had a bunch of questions while we've been on the call, and I just want to briefly address a few of those before I turn over to Ben again with the final closing words. One of the questions was, do we have attorneys or volunteers without language skills or experience in this area volunteering in Dili? Absolutely, we do. If you're interested in volunteering, you should definitely get in touch with Maheen from AILA, and she can let you know what you would need. Often we do find if you're a non-Spanish speaker, bringing an interpreter with you is going to make you a whole lot more useful and engaged on the ground. So to the extent you'd have the capacity to bring somebody, that would be a huge help. But we can still use you in many ways, off the ground and on the ground. So please get in touch, and we can let you know how you can get involved. There were some questions about more about what ICE is telling the mothers about their release and ankle monitoring. Is every woman getting an ankle monitor? That is the push. The push seems to be for everybody to leave with an ankle monitor. And the meeting to which we are not allowed as attorneys, even when we have a G28 form, representation form on file with ICE, in those meetings the women are telling us, they're writing sworn affidavits telling us that ICE is telling them they shouldn't bother paying bond. Bond is going to be $10,000. It's going to take anywhere from 2 to 4 months for them to get to go before an immigration judge, which can be true in some cases because at various stages in the process, ICE actually holds the cards to continuing the process. So they can hold up the process by not filing the NTA, not delivering a decision to the woman. There's various stages at which they can insert delay. So actually we have seen that played out. And if a woman doesn't want an ankle monitor, she does have to wait longer in detention. It should not be that much longer, but unfortunately, ICE holds the power there, so we have to hold them accountable and push them on individual cases and as a policy matter. Other questions that we've received are children being released on their own recognizance with their mothers? This is not something that we've seen, people being released without a bond. We saw a couple of those immediately after the first Flores decision came down this summer, July 24th. The judges were thinking that was a really good sign, and they went ahead and released a few women without the bond, kind of conditional parole. But we're not seeing that now. Absolutely, everybody is leaving with an ankle monitor. The average bond that we're getting before the immigration judge is between $1,500 and I would say $2,500. There's been more questions coming in. I'll just ask a couple of them. You know, ICE is moving people in and out of the facility faster each day. Where are they moving to? These people are being, women and children are being released to family members within the U.S. Often they have a spouse, a parent, a sister-in-law, a cousin, or a family friend. So I think there's an overwhelming number of them who have a place to go. They're generally being released to family and friends. I think we learned recently that there were maybe only a few individuals who did not have family and friends in the U.S. to whom they could be released, of the thousands that have been processed through family detention facilities.
Right, but as somebody, I think Ian probably raises that we are trying to build capacity, and Rice has been doing a great job in trying to do some orientation of these folks so that it isn't just a situation where they get, you know, dropped off by ICE at a bus station with, you know, no information and no real chance of understanding what's the next step in the process. I mean, ultimately, somebody asked a question about, you know, the advocacy strategies. Ultimately, you know, I think the message that we want to send out is definitely to end family detention, right? This is an abomination. This is not who we are as a country. This is, you know, a fundamental violation of the rights of children and the rights of asylum seekers. So we definitely want to end the practice of family detention, but I think we also want to be able to put forward a vision of how we can not only do this more humanely, but we can do this better. The best way to ensure that these folks will show up for their hearings is not to give them ankle bracelets, not to put the fear of God into them, but to put information in their hands and access to people that can help them. Because the overwhelming majority of these folks have gotten a positive, credible fear finding, the indications are these are going to be very winnable asylum claims. When people have access to information and are told that we think you can win your case, that's when they show up to hearings. So I think from an advocacy's perspective, we want to say, let's end family detention and let's stand up a system that's not only reflective of our values, but one that works in terms of our overall goals, which is finding out the facts of these cases and doing the right things by these people based on the facts of their cases. Anyway, sorry, Lindsay, go ahead.
No, that's absolutely right, Ben, and I think that underscores again why, even though our staff are already doing so much, we need them to do more. And as soon as we get the green light, and we've been asking for months to do these pre-release orientations with ICE so that we can actually meet with women and have a few volunteers in a session to equip them with the names and phone numbers of attorneys who can represent them and organizations throughout the country in their destination, where their final destination, where they're heading. That's really, really important to make sure these families get the representation and the services they need upon release. Another question that came in was about the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights report that came out yesterday. Obviously, the council is thrilled to see that body weighing in on this issue. You know, their findings were absolutely consistent with our own findings. They actually had heard from the CARA Project and friends of the CARA Project during their investigation on this issue. And to the extent that they only visited Carnes and Port Isabel detention facilities, we can absolutely confirm that all of the egregious things that they observed are going on at Dilley too. So we very much welcome that report coming down yesterday.
Excellent. All right, so I want to just, I know some folks dropping off, some folks joining. I just want to reiterate that we need your help. We need resources for this effort. So you're going to be receiving requests for donations. If you can't give, I need you to send that email to somebody who you think can give. We're trying to make this as easy as possible. You could right now text a message, text the word DILLEY, D-I-L-L-E-Y, to 41444. to make a donation right now. You know, I'm sorry to make this sound like a telethon, but this matters. We cannot stand back and do nothing while this kind of abuse continues to happen. So that's the reason that we're doing this. We need your support. This is not something, this is a project that I'm, you know, unfortunately we're going to, you know, continuing to look to foundations and other funders for the kind of support that often happens in the immigration world, but that's not happening here. This really is being driven by individual and very small family foundation support. So this, if we're going to continue, we need your help.
And I'll just add that to the extent that you had questions that you sent in that we haven't been able to answer with everybody on the line, we will follow up with you individually and answer those questions.
All right. So I think we're there. We're at 2:50, I think you're respectful of folks' time. Lindsay or Ian or Isabel, any final closing thoughts or comments we want to make?
I just want to really thank Ian and Isabel for taking time off the floor today. We know that you're very much needed back in that trailer, and we so appreciate your time, your energy, your dedication. I've said this to you personally, but I'll say it with everyone on the line. What you're doing on behalf of these families, along with Brian and the volunteers down there, is truly heroic. So thank you for what you're doing, and we really hope that we can get some more support and that we can effectively end this thing together.
This is Ian. I'd just like to, first of all, thank you for those kind words, but also like to reiterate the importance of this project being the sum of all of its parts. And while the on-the-ground work is obviously essential, the majority of what's happening to push this project forward and really defend these women and offer them what they deserve upon entrance to the United States, the majority of it's happening outside of the on-the-ground efforts, and everybody has an opportunity to participate that in many different ways. So we really thank you all for being a part of this, and we encourage your ideas and your thoughts and your strategies for how we push this thing forward.
This is Isabel. Yes, I agree with Ian and Lindsay. Thank you, and Ms. Johnson. And it's an honor for me to be part of this organization. And, you know, I want to thank the volunteers who have been on the ground and everyone who supports this project, because we couldn't do it without you all. Thank you.
And travel down to Dili. Come and see us again. Somebody asked the current need that we have for on-the-ground volunteers. We're very thin on volunteers in October. So please, if you're thinking about going down, come on down. If you can't come down, think about responding to the call for help and spreading the word that we need help. We need volunteers. We need funding. We need to shut this thing down.
Thank you all very much.